Lowe's knows you want the best for dad. This Father's Day, help him take on any project with big deals on DeWalt. Right now, get a free XR 8 amp hour battery when you buy select DeWalt tools. That's not all. Get up to two free select tools when you buy a select DeWalt 20 volt max battery kit. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a work load is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.
The In-Between is intended for mature audiences and may include topics that can be unsettling, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, murder, and animal abuse. Testimony shared by guests of the show is their own and does not reflect the views of Mel Barrett, Ruby Grace Productions, or Grab Bag Collab. Listener discretion is advised.
Can we admit that we're all transfixed by that sick little soap opera trial in Exeter, New Hampshire?
What time did you get here today?
1:30 this morning.
1:30. Why?
Want to get a front row seat, I guess.
If this story were a made-for-TV movie, and it surely will be, you might not believe it.
Date is August 1st, 1990. Time is 10 a.m. Seabrook, New Hampshire. We're about to do a one-party consent via telephone.
Sat around brainstorming the pros and cons of slitting a man's throat rather than firing a 38 caliber projectile through his head.
Yes.
There's only one person in the state of New York who is sitting in prison tonight with a sentence of life with absolutely no possibility of parole.
Yes, I need a policeman. 4D Misty Morning Drive.
Okay, what's going on over there, ma'am?
There's somebody screaming for help outside.
The family's outraged. The two men that went in the house and took my son away from me, coming out of the courtroom, chewing gum, slapping hands, and smiling. Who could do something like that and have no remorse? Remorse.
The kids. The boys. That's how most people describe Bill Flynn, Patrick Pete Randall, J.R. Latimy, and Ray Fowler, the four teens who were convicted of murdering and accomplice to murder of Greg Smart. It's accurate. All four men were under the age of 20 when they murdered Greg. Though, to be clear, Ray Fowler did not participate in the murder, though that story will require some digging in later episodes, so stay tuned. Raymond allegedly hung out in the getaway car with JR. JR supplied the gun to Bill Flynn, who was convicted of pulling the trigger, though some speculate that's not true. Those doubters aren't suggesting he didn't have a hand in attacking Greg and participating in the murder, but they believe there's a distinct possibility that Pete Randall was the actual trigger man. More on this in a bit. In this episode of The In-Between, I'm going to go on a deep, deep dive about the teens involved in the murder. I will portray who they were at the time and where they are now to the best of my ability. The judge in the case, Judge Douglas Gray, would not allow the juvenile criminal records of the teens involved in the murder into court, but based on what I've seen in the police reports, I will be touching on their behavior in the year leading up to the murder, as, in my opinion, it is relevant to who they were at the time and sheds some light on how all this happened. Most of the source material comes from their own testimony at trial, eyewitness testimony, and signed affidavits detailing who these guys were before, during, and after the crime. I've reached out to every number, email, and Facebook account I could find for all of the teens involved in Greg's murder, in the hopes that some of them would speak to me for the podcast. But as of this recording, I've not heard back from any of them. I'll keep trying. And for the record, I have no intention of victim blaming and hold firm in my belief that Bill Flynn was a victim of sexual misconduct in an asymmetrical power dynamic with a woman who was 5 years older and held a position of authority over him. Bill was 16 at the time of the sexual relationship with Pamela Smart and the murder of Greg Smart. Ray was 18, Pete was 17, JR was also 17, and Cecilia Pierce, Pam's intern, was 15 at the time. Put a pin in that. Just in case you need a reminder, there is real science backing the idea that teens shouldn't be held accountable as full-grown adults for their actions. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, quote, "The brain finishes developing and maturing in the mid to late 20s. The part of the brain behind the forehead called the prefrontal cortex is one of the last parts to mature. This area is responsible for skills like planning, prioritizing, and making good decisions," end quote. I think it's fair to say that everyone involved in the murder, including the victim, could be described as kids. I've spoken in depth with advocates who want to change the laws governing life without parole sentences to reduce sentencing for folks under the ages of 25, 21, and 18. The Sentencing Project in Washington, D.C. has been advocating for 35 years for this population. According to their website, the Sentencing Project advocates for effective and humane responses to crime that minimizes imprisonment and criminalization of youth and adults by promoting racial, ethnic, economic, and gender justice. I asked Ashley Nellis of the Sentencing Project about brain development in a recent interview. Here's Ashley explaining how the brain works.
So the current science shows that the brain and important parts, relevant parts of the human brain are not fully developed until mid to late 20s. There's a growing area of research in this that shows that prefrontal cortex in particular, which is where executive functioning lies, is still unformed and not yet sort of firing on all pistons. So what that means is that a lot of people, most people, are still acting impulsively and not able to sort of restrain. And we see that, of course, in teenagers and young adults all the time across a number of domains.
So now that we've established that folks under, let's say, the age of 25 are basically walking around with half brains, let's discuss who these people were and what they were doing in their daily lives before Greg was brutally murdered. Side note, I'm only going to touch briefly on Cecilia Pierce's role in the murder in this episode. There's a lot more to unpack there, so keep an eye out on the Patreon for future episodes focused on Cecilia's role. Memory and conception are tricky. I'm trying to keep in mind that a lot of people don't have memories of this trial as I and the people of New Hampshire do. I can tell you from my memory, there are several points that always stuck out. There was Pamela Smart, of course, made up conservatively, always in dresses with a bow in her hair, anger and shock creasing the lines of her young face. The sneer on Patrick Randall's face as he testified about his obsession with guns and violence. I remember Cecilia Pierce's snarky attitude toward both the defense and the prosecutor, rolling her eyes until I thought they'd fall out of her head.
On direct, you told Mr. Maggiato that you called Bill Flynn. Did you call Bill Flynn?
Yes, I called him.
The judge saying he hoped Clint Eastwood would play him in the movie of the trial. I remember Helen Hunt acting like a psychopath in the film Murder in New Hampshire, as she chastised a young, blonde, whipped Chad Allen for not following through the plan to kill her husband.
Either you're a coward or you never really loved me. Which is it?
I do love you.
So you're a coward?
No.
Right, you never loved me. Which is good, because you make me sick.
And I remember Bill Flynn crying on the stand while he was testifying. Of all the images above, the last one sticks out to me. And maybe you, if you recollect anything about this case more than any other.
I said, God forgive me.
He said, God forgive me. What happened?
I pulled the trigger.
This image of 16-year-old Bill Flynn, his mullet combed and less wild, crying on the stand, was always juxtaposed for me with the image of Bill Flynn entering the courtroom to testify. When he's entering the courtroom, he's swinging his arms, popping his fists together, chomping on gum, smirking at the cameras. This never sat right with me as a 15-year-old and as a 40-something-year-old. Maybe the same way that Pamela's bow and her stern expression never sat right with some of you. After seeing Bill make his walk down the long hall toward the courtroom, there was something I didn't believe about his tears on the stand. It felt still and calculated. It felt performative. Was he just trying to be a badass and not show any emotion as he sauntered into the courtroom? On the stand, did he mean it when he cried, or was it forced? I'll remind you, these are my observations. They are not fact. But how do we discern fact when testimony relies on emotion and memory? More on this after a quick break. In almost every description of the teens involved in Greg Smart's murder, you will hear the words, quote, wrong side of the tracks, end quote. I can tell you I understand what that means. When I was growing up, Seabrook and Hampton, New Hampshire were considered the wrong side of every track. Seabrook and Hampton Beaches are sister beach towns, kind of smack dab in the middle between the Maine and Massachusetts borders. I think of this area as the ugly stepchild to the Jersey Shore. That was especially the case back in 1990. It's mostly a stretch of boardwalk that curves along the ocean. There are cheap beachside motels with detoxing, semi-permanent residents, ice cream shops, seafood takeout, a stretch of an arcade with an open front facing the beach, broken syringes littering beach sand, the boardwalk, and the street, t-shirt shops displaying shirts with slogans like, "Silly faggot, dicks are for chicks." I'm not making this up. I was about 10 when I first saw that shirt, and I think I knew then that I wasn't welcome in Hampton. Also, I apologize for saying the F word. I fucking hate that word. I wasn't allowed to go to Hampton alone with my friends. I didn't want to go to Hampton alone, even as an adult. I remember we had a bad hurricane one year, and the tide was so high it almost washed out the boardwalk, and I thought, please wipe it out. Let's just start over with this place. When my uncles needed to sell coke or get high themselves, they went to Seabrook and Hampton. There was always a police presence and the smell of rotting fish and just decay. Bill Flynn and his crew were from Seabrook. They had been described as quote-unquote thugs. I personally hate that word, and I'm sure a lot of you do too. I think it definitely has a different connotation today than it did in mostly white New Hampshire in the 1990s. Still, it's what they were called, so I'm gonna say it. I think Bill and his crew were called thugs because of the criminal records they'd accumulated leading up to Greg Smart's murder, which Judge Gray didn't allow into the trial because they were all juveniles at the time. Here's the defense's cross-examination of Pete Randall for context.
You beat up Ralph, right?
That had nothing to do with the murder.
That had nothing to do with the murder.
Ralph had said things that I didn't like. I mean, he had said things that about me being mean and maybe hurting a kid, a little kid that I really cared for.
So you didn't like that, so you beat Ralph up?
I didn't beat Ralph up. He attacked me.
He attacked you and you strangled him and smashed his head against the rock?
I just protected myself.
Okay, so that was just self-defense?
Yes.
So if Ralph says something different, he must be mistaken.
I'd suggest he thinks about it.
After poring over the 1,000-plus pages of police reports and witness interrogations, I too can tell you these kids weren't as pristine as they were made out to be. Honestly, I hate that I'm even saying the sentence, but let's not forget how they treated Pam's beloved dog, Halen, which I've referenced in earlier episodes. According to the National Institutes of Health, there is a direct, quote, evidence to suggest that animal abuse is associated with the possession of psychopathic traits, end quote. The media really clung to the image of doe-eyed Bill Flynn crying on the stand. But one of their teachers, Mr. Barron, who ironically taught a class called Law, Crime, and Punishment, said that when JR and Bill were in his class doing a mock trial, both boys volunteered to be the criminals in the case and suggested that the crime should be a quote-unquote killing spree. Barron dismissed their idea and instead chose, quote, radical terrorism against the use of fetal pigs by the science class at Winnicunnet. Bill and JR then volunteered to play the students who had killed their science teacher. Man, the 90s were wild, huh? In another instance, Miss Omond, a school social worker, reported to the project self-esteem facilitators that she had been made aware that JR, Bill, and Pete were all doing cocaine. After she reported them, JR and Bill came into her office while she was seeing other students and threatened her, saying, quote, if you pursue this any further, we're going to have to do something about you, end quote.
State's objections to the motion for new trial is in.
I'll never forget the shock I experienced when combing through the case file in the Rockingham Superior Court, and I stumbled upon.
I find out, swastika had anything to do with you leaving. Who's that from? Bill? Wow. There's a swastika in this letter. Wow. Wow, wow, wow.
An actual fucking swastika. In the case file.
That's from the judge.
Bill Flynn, from prison, was writing to his buddies on the outside and turning his O's into swastikas. I may have vomited a little in my mouth when I saw the original letter in Bill's handwriting. I know that anti-Semitism, unfortunately, isn't uncommon, but what does this tell us about Bill Flynn at the time he and his buddies murdered Greg Smart? Bill lived at home with a single mom. He went to Winnicunnet High School and hung out with Pete Randall, J.R. Latimy, and Ray Fowler. And by hung out, I mean they grew up together and eventually drove around burglarizing cars and houses together while simultaneously buying and selling coke together. During this time, Pete Randall also beat the shit out of his stepdad with a baseball bat. I want to take a pause here and quickly talk about how kids who grow up in lower income households often don't make the decision to be bad. They have to get by somehow. Of course, not all kids who are lower income engage in violent criminal behavior, but some do because it's all they know. I'm not excusing the behavior. These are the facts as we know them. Flynn, Randall, Latimy, Fowler, and Pierce came from poverty, addiction, and violence. And in turn, they engaged in crime, addiction, and violence. I think you can imagine that when Bill Flynn met Pam Smart in Project Self-Esteem, the program she ran for the Media Center, she must have looked like a shiny beacon of hope and possibility of freedom from teenage hell to him. I think about my partner's kids. We have a 15-year-old who has an older sibling who is 20. Our 15-year-old idolizes the 20-year-old, and they also hang out together, go shopping, grab takeout, gossip, exchange clothes and shoes. I think I know the situations are very different, but I guess I don't have a concern about an older half-sibling hanging out with our 15-year-old. They're not very far apart in age and circumstance. There's some commonality there. Cecilia Pierce was 15 when she became Pamela Smart's intern at the Media Center, and I imagine the two had a similar sisterly relationship. Cecilia idolized Pam, and Pam, in turn, felt like she had a little fangirl to hang out with. Pete Randall is the enigma here to me. He was a self-proclaimed wannabe hitman, and though I don't know much about his childhood, I would assume he came from violence. He was brutal, angry, cocky, and probably scared most of the time.
We're still the same kids we were.
Same kids?
Yes.
Still ripping off stereos from cars and stuff?
Occasionally.
Still stealing motorcycles?
Occasionally, yes.
Still buying dope?
Occasionally.
Using dope?
Yes.
Drinking?
Yes.
What I am convinced of, and this is my opinion, of course, is that Bill Flynn didn't actually kill Greg Smart. I think Pete did. Let me explain. Of the many pages of witness interviews, over and over, the kids and some adults around Bill, Pete, and JR say none of them believed Bill would have had the stones to go through with it. They all thought Pete would be the one. He was the one constantly talking about being a quote-unquote professional killer, like a soldier. It's my opinion that because of the relationship with Pam Smart, the DA, Paul Maggiato, decided Bill was the catalyst and the trigger man. So everyone's stories needed to line up with Bill being manipulated by Pam. Despite the fact that a forensics expert at the trial deemed it nearly impossible for a left-handed person like Bill Flynn to have been the one to shoot Greg Smart in the head.
Putting it all together, Doctor, wouldn't you agree with me that the most likely scenario based on your findings is a person very close in contact or very close to contact with something intermediate between the gun and standing perhaps more in front of Greg Smart or perhaps slightly to the side?
Assuming that his head is straight ahead, right. Yes. He's turned very far to the left, but of course the shooter could be to the left of her.
I could go on a months-long tirade about blood spatter. If we want to know who the shooter was, there are a few ways to figure it out. I wish the defense had dug a little deeper here. Since they didn't, I'm going to. One, if Bill was the shooter, remember, he's left-handed, standing directly behind Greg, and he's never shot someone in the head that we know of. He would have had to point the gun at the frontish part of the left side of Greg's head, contorting himself into an awkward position, place an intermediary or a silencer between the gun and Greg's head, and then pull the trigger, all while trying to keep Greg from moving. Remember, Pete was just holding Greg from the front with a fistful of his hair, so Bill is also risking that he might shoot himself when he was behind Greg. Now, if all of that actually happened, first, Bill must be the goddess Durja because he'd have to have a few extra hands to pull this off. Also, Bill's clothes, the wall, probably his skin, would have had some blood spatter on it. The intermediary certainly would. So where's the intermediary? The police never found it. Two, if Pete was the shooter, he's allegedly standing in front of Greg, holding Greg's hair so he can't move. Pete is right-handed, so I'm assuming he'd be holding Greg's hair with his left hand without contorting himself. He could put an intermediary against Greg's head, point the gun and shoot in the exact trajectory Dr. Fossum describes, and it's done. Why are we contorting ourselves into the story that Bill shot Greg? Even Raymond Fowler, in his police interview, wasn't sure who did it. In the police interview with Raymond, Detective Surrett asks, quote, Raymond, which one of them said that they shot the guy, end quote. And Raymond Fowler says, quote, I don't know. I just told you. I mean, like 40 times. I'm telling you what I know now, end quote. Raymond, who is obviously under an overwhelming amount of stress in this interview, as the detective pressures him for answers it doesn't seem like he has, finally says at the end of the interview that he thinks it was Bill who shot Greg, but he never really sounds sure. According to Bernard Dow, aka Twiggy, a late 20-something who hung around with Bill, Pete, JR, and Raymond, he says Raymond told him about the seconds after Greg was shot in the head. Twiggy says, quote, and then he laughed and saying blood spattered all over the place or something, end quote. Twiggy's testimony is also interesting because he tells investigators that Raymond says he was in the condo with Pete and Bill the night they killed Greg, not in the car with JR. More on this in later episodes. So my question again is, why did the Derry police and the New Hampshire State Police never do blood spatter analysis? And if they did, why didn't they record it anywhere? The reason it's important that Pete and not Bill may have been the trigger man is because it goes against the state's narrative that Bill was so manipulated by Pam that he would do whatever she wanted. But if Pete were the actual shooter, he was driven by greed and his own violent tendencies, and that's all. He had no relationship with Pam Smart. I suppose there are two schools of thought as to why there's a question about who the shooter was. What does it matter, right? Greg Smart was murdered, and either Bill or Pete did it. But it's important to me and anyone who wants to get to the truth. My initial theory was that it makes the prosecutor's case and narrative lock tight if the shooter is Bill. He's the one who had the affair with Pam. He's the one who was manipulated by Pam. Everything else falls in line and case closed. Pam has a different theory that I find interesting, and maybe you will too. I don't have audio of our conversation for this one, as it happened in the middle of a head cold and I was sleeping when she called, but here's what she told me. If you pay attention to the testimony of Pete and JR, you'll hear them repeatedly say they did this for Bill. They have very little interaction and don't claim to know Pam very well at all. Pam thinks that Bill felt so guilty for getting his friends into the situation that he took the blame for pulling the trigger. Pretty solid theory, but one that we're still going to have to peel back the layers of by going down the rabbit hole of evidence. I've been combing through the court file and the police records, which thankfully landed in my lap, and I'm trying to determine what evidence may have been destroyed. Yes, you heard that right. Destroyed. I found an official request to Greg Smart's mother and father that asked if they wanted to keep Greg's personal effects, to which they said yes. But the police go a step further and ask if they want everything else found at the scene destroyed. You know, the evidence.
How do we go about finding out if evidence has been destroyed?
By their moms?
By the court.
I do not know yet. I mean, I would think that if they filed a motion requesting that evidence not be destroyed, there would have to be some sort of order on the motion saying we destroyed the evidence, your motion is denied, or your motion is granted or not.
But I'm assuming that Pam would have to go through her lawyers for that to happen. She couldn't just send a letter saying don't destroy my evidence.
Well, it looked like there was a motion not to destroy the evidence that we were just looking at.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it wouldn't have been, must have been through her lawyers.
The same letter was sent to Pam, and she tells me that through her lawyer, she asked that the evidence in her case not be destroyed. I haven't found that correspondence to be a part of the record, so I'm tracking it down. How devastating would it be if the state of New Hampshire destroyed the evidence in her case? Pretty friggin' devastating. So stay tuned. I'm tracking down the evidence and will hopefully have an answer for you in coming episodes. Back to Bill, Pete, and JR. Three of the teens were housed together at the Rockingham County Jail, where they were being held before and during the trial. That seems an odd housing choice, if you ask me. Could it have been to get their story straight? That brings us to J.R. Latimy and Ray Fowler. Vance J.R. Latimy, the getaway driver, was the crux of how they all got caught. He'd stolen his father's gun to use as the murder weapon. Then Ralph Welch, who was a childhood bestie of J.R. and Pete and living with the Latimys at the time, heard a rumor from a friend. Bill, Pete, J.R., and Ralph's cousin Raymond had killed Greg Smart. Ralph confronted J.R. and Pete. They denied it. But Ralph didn't believe them, so he left and eavesdropped on them. What he heard chilled his blood.
Right, now you tiptoed back, you said, what happened after that?
Well, I had heard in a whispered voice, I don't know who said it, I had just heard, Bill's gonna be pissed. Yeah, you know who's gonna be next.
And when you heard that, Bill's gonna be pissed, you know who's gonna be next, what did you do?
I burst into the room.
Pete was supposedly cavalier in his explanation of how and why they murdered Greg. Ralph confronted him, and Pete beat the shit out of Ralph. After the fight, Ralph had had enough. He told JR's parents everything, and Latimy Sr. got out his gun. He found that it had just been cleaned. Diane Latimy, JR's mom, called the police and told them she had information about the murder. Before Ralph went to the police, he received a phone call from Bill.
As he talked to you, he sounded desperate, didn't he?
Yes.
He sounded desperate that Pam shouldn't find out about this.
That nobody should find out about it.
But what he said to you was...
If Pam finds out, yes.
Pam finds out about this, she'll never speak to me again.
Yes.
He tried to get you in that phone conversation. He tried to get you to come meet him somewhere, didn't he?
Yes.
And you, Billy Flynn, did you say, Bill, yeah, I'll be right over there and meet him?
No.
Okay, did you go meet him?
No.
Did you tell the people in the jury why Billy Flynn, your friend, why you wouldn't go meet him that night?
Because I figured they'd probably try to do something to me, probably like kill me or something.
Ralph told the jury more about the demeanor of Pete, JR, and Bill in the months leading up to the murder and the other attempts on Greg's life.
I was going into the Latimer's house and Bill was coming off of the steps. And he was like laughing and joking around about it. And he had said, oh, we're going to go do Greg. He said, and he had mentioned that it's going to take Pam's car, something like that.
Now, this is Bill Flynn, right?
Excuse me? Bill Flynn. Oh, I thought you said Bill.
I'm sorry, Bill Flynn.
Yes.
Before Greg's dead, laughing and joking and telling you in a joking way that he's going to take Pam's car to Greg's car.
Yes.
He wasn't overcome with grief, as he told you this, was he?
No, he was, like, joking around. He was laughing. That's why I didn't take him seriously.
Was he laughing so hard there were tears coming out of his eyes?
No.
Were there any tears coming out of his eyes?
No.
There were also anonymous tips called into the Derry police as well as from co-workers of Cecilia Pierce, but we'll dive into that in later episodes. Ray Fowler is the one of these things is not like the other character in this story. Raymond Fowler has already admitted that he waited in the car the night Gregory Smart was murdered, though his brother Robert says he wasn't even supposed to be there.
The testimony that Bill and them gave was all bullshit on the stand. That wasn't even how it really went down, because I talked to Ronnie, which was my cousin Ralph's father, which is, you know, that's why I'm related to him, because of his father. Mm-hmm. So Raymond kind of knew what the boys were planning on doing, but he didn't know what day they were doing shit. They were always changing things, you know, always kind of like making the things up on the fly, you know, let's go here or whatever. So Raymond was helping Ronnie put in a windshield in a car that day. So they all came over to get Raymond. They kind of egged him on and said, come on, Raymond, you got to go with us, got to go with us. But Raymond didn't want to go because he kind of had an idea what they were planning on doing.
Right.
And he didn't want to go. And he said, so he finished up with Ronnie. And then he said, well, just drop me off over at Hampton because we're going that way to get on 101. So Raymond got in the car with them going over to get dropped off in Hampton. He thought they'd just drop him off. Well, they didn't. They drove to Derry.
He claimed in his interrogation that Pam Smart didn't have anything to do with the murder, and he thought that they were just going to burglarize the Smarts' home, not murder anyone. And here's Ray's police interview.
Did you know that Pam was going to pay them money to kill her husband? Yes or no?
No.
You thought that Bill was going to kill the guy because he wanted to, but Pamela didn't ask him to kill her husband?
No, I didn't tell him.
When did you go to the police when you knew that a guy had been murdered?
The audio quality is awful, so I'll translate. Basically, the detective asked Raymond if he knew Pam was going to pay them money to kill Greg, and Raymond says no. It gets complicated because the detective asks, quote, you thought Bill was going to kill the guy because he wanted to, end quote. I wish he'd finished his sentence, but Raymond interjects and says that he, Bill, quote unquote, likes her. And the detective again, quote, but Pamela didn't ask him to kill her husband, end quote. Raymond says, quote, no, I never talked to her, end quote. This is wishy-washy at best, but Raymond's brother Robert and their family have always claimed that Raymond would have testified that Pam wasn't involved in the planning of Greg's murder. But again, Ray is off on an island for the rest of the story. It is believed that the prosecution didn't want Ray anywhere near the case because his testimony would sow doubt with the jury. Pam tells me that they had Raymond on their witness list before he was arrested and charged. He would have testified that she had nothing to do with the planning of the murder. But when the police arrested Raymond, he would have to plead the fifth, so as to not incriminate himself, and could no longer testify on her behalf. Interesting timing on the state's part. Here's Robert Fowler, Raymond's brother, explaining what happened to Raymond as he was about to testify.
So they threw up a bunch of spaghetti to see if it would stick on the wall. Right?
Yeah, like burglary, accomplice, all that.
They got him for a speeding ticket for like 2 years before or something stupid. Like, you know, I'm just exaggerating, but
yeah.
You know, they tried to throw as much at him that he had to do a plea bargain.
Okay.
So, but I was at the attorney's office when Raymond was on the phone, a conference call with us down there, because he was asking to be my mother. This is when, before he made the plea bargain, we're talking to the attorney. So Raymond asked my mother, asked everybody around the circle, you know, what they thought, what he should do, what they thought he should do. And so they get to Rob, and guess what Rob says?
What does Rob say?
I would fight the motherfuckers.
Yeah, yeah.
My exact words. I would fight the motherfuckers because they don't want to try you before them. They don't want to push this case, your case ahead of hers, and you couldn't request it.
Right.
You had the leverage. Raymond had leverage before that.
What was his leverage?
the leverage was that if he wanted a speedy trial, they're going to have a really hard time with Pam's case. Because all the information that would have came out for Pam's case would have been already out in Raymond's case as it was testified to.
Yeah.
They couldn't change it in the Pam's case. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It would have complicated her case all the way around.
Yeah.
So they did not want this. So the state was gambling on the fact that if they keep him quiet, don't put him in the trial, that they could have this slam dunk case that they put together.
While awaiting trial, JR and Bill shared a cell, and Pete was just down the hall. But for some reason, Raymond was separated from JR, Bill, and Pete. Robert Fowler posits that this was because Raymond had a different story from the other teens and wasn't cooperating with the state. And from here on out, Raymond is quietly dealt with by the state. His name comes up in most of the witness testimony, but no one ever questioned why he wasn't there telling his version of events. That's why I think it's important to question it now. I had a lengthy conversation with Rob Fowler about the circumstances surrounding the events that happened on May 1st, 1990. And though I can't include all of it here, I do intend to release that interview later on to give even more insight into who these kids were, including what Rob says happened in his home the night of the murder. So stay tuned for future episodes on that. Let's take a quick break and then we'll get back to it.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Okay, we left off with Bill, JR, Pete, and Raymond awaiting trial, sitting in prison. An eyewitness account from fellow inmate Ricky Davis, who wrote and signed an affidavit about his experiences in prison with the teens, states, they worked out their story there, joked about Pam and the trial, and even discussed how Bill said he would force a motion on the stand. Here's Ricky Davis in his own words, paraphrasing what he submitted in an affidavit in February of 2009 from the documentary Captivated. I'll have Jeff read Ricky's words for you since the producers of Captivated won't allow me to use this clip.
I caught him in the morning, him and Pete doing lines on a desk in a room. Caught him one morning, I opened up the door and they were banging lines before they were going to testify. And he goes, it makes me more emotional on the stand. He says, don't you know this? Don't you know this? Don't you know this? Because I used to sit there and watch the boys. When they come back in, they would watch themselves on TV and I was with them and we would all sit around. You know, we'd smoke a bone in the cell, a joint, a reefer, a weed, marijuana, whatever you want to call it. We were doing everything. We were doing especially marijuana, morphine, Valiums, and the cocaine, of course. Billy told me straight out that, listen, Rick, he says, we gotta do what we gotta do. And I'm not taking my boys down with me for the rest of our lives. We're not doing it.
Davis also later wrote to Linda Wojcicki that Bill had told him he had committed the quote-unquote perfect crime and that, in fact, Pete shot Greg Smart. Pam's defense attorney, Mark Sisti, got wind of the bragging. According to the 2018 petition, another jailhouse snitch, Derek Stead, who was in prison with Bill, Pete, and JR, wrote to Linda Wojcicki as well with information that directly contradicted Bill's testimony. Derek wrote, quote, Bill Flynn had told me that he had killed Greg Smart, et cetera, and he was going to blame everything on your daughter, Pam. Bill had also told me he killed Greg out of or because he was jealous. Basically, they told me they were going to blame everything on Pam, end quote. But the craziest thing to me are the letters Bill and JR were writing to family and friends on the outside about their motivation to take a plea and testify against Pamela. In a 2018 petition for a commutation of her sentence, Pamela Smart brought forth evidence that her Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights had been trampled on. I'm going to read part of the petition to you. Keep in mind that petitioner is Pam Smart. From the petition, her defense says, the state's main witnesses were co-defendants Vance Latimy, Patrick Randall, and William Flynn. Both prior to and during the trial, Randall and Latimy were housed together in jail. The three had ample opportunity to and did, in fact, speak to each other about the petitioner's case. Each of the co-defendants admitted they planned to stick together. One would accept a plea bargain only if the other was also going to accept a plea bargain. This was decided before the start of the petitioner's trial. Courts in other jurisdictions have held that where accomplices testify with an expectation of leniency from the prosecutor, their testimony is particularly suspicious. People versus Marmelstein, 1985. Randall and Flynn planned to conform their testimony and did so throughout the trial. Both Flynn and Lattimie sent letters to a third party, Douglas Abrams. Further, Lattimie exchanged numerous letters with a girlfriend. Defense counsel obtained these letters while the prosecution was still presenting its case in chief, but after Flynn and Lattimie concluded testifying. At this time, it became apparent that the letters demonstrated there was a concerted plan to conform testimony. Counsel objected that the letters demonstrated fabrication and that they raised serious constitutional issues. Counsel requested that the witness be brought back for further testimony upon discovery of the letters and for further testimony regarding the motivations of Flynn, Lattimie, and Randall. The court denied petitioner's motion to recall the co-defendants. It is well within the trial court's discretion to recall witnesses who have already testified in State v. Marski, 1964. The court denied petitioner's motion to recall the defendants, stating, the letters contain no information which in any way contradicted the testimony of the two individuals while on the witness stand, but at best showed their attempts at, quote-unquote, jailhouse bravado. The Flynn letter clearly demonstrates the underlying motivation in testifying. I'm going to have my good friend Todd read Bill Flynn's letter so you have a clear understanding of the above appeal in motion.
When we were arrested, as you know, we were kids, which meant the state had to spend over 6 months to certify us. While Pam was an adult, she'd just got a trial date, which means she could go to trial long before us, leaving her the option that if she was found guilty to testify against us for a lesser charge. You see, she had already told people that if she was found guilty, she would testify against us. Now with Raymond, we owe him. He already testified against us. We're going to return the favor.
Okay, back to the petition. Co-defendant Flynn was obviously under the impression that he had to testify against petitioner before petitioner testified against him. The letter also demonstrates that the co-defendants would act together, quote, we had no choice, her or us, end quote. A letter written by Flynn a week earlier on February 6, 1991, reinforces the fact that his underlying motivation was his fear that petitioner would testify against him. Flynn also wrote of the concern the attorney general had that he would testify that the petitioner was innocent. Here's Todd again reading another letter Bill Flynn sent.
All the jurors have been picked, I guess. Bunch of bullshitting assholes, if you ask me. Pam's lawyers have filed a motion to not let us testify. I pray to God they get it. I hate myself for having to do this, but I just don't have a choice. I'll never forget the day they told me she said she'd testify against us if she got convicted. The attorney general's afraid I'll get on the stand and say she's innocent.
Did you hear that? I've read it 100 times just to make sure I understand. Bill Flynn wanted the defense to win on their motion that Flynn and crew not be able to testify and that the AG is worried he's going to get up there and say she's innocent. I guess you can argue that Bill's still obsessed with Pam, but when I read this, I see reasonable doubt about the story that Flynn and his crew were telling. Should the jurors have had access to these letters? Should Pam's defense have been allowed to recall the witnesses to the stand? In my gut, I think yes. I don't know if this is based on fact or feeling, but I know I want it.
What I don't want is to see a handwritten swastika in Bill's letters. But alas, there it was. Sorry to harp on it. I literally just can't get over it. A fucking swastika. Okay, back to the petition.
New Hampshire Rules of Evidence Rule 603 concerns the taking of the witness's oath and affirmation, quote, before testifying, every witness shall be required to declare that he or she will testify truthfully by oath or affirmation calculated to awaken the conscience and impress his or her mind with the duty to do so, end quote. I guess this was just a reminder to the court, but it went unheeded by Judge Gray.
Have I been going over this with my friends? No, I haven't.
You talked to Randall about that?
We've talked before in about this case, but we've never once, never said, all right, this is what we're going to say, or all right, you say this and I say this.
Well, back as, you know, recently as June of 1990, you were concerned about getting your story together, weren't you?
Yeah, that was with Raymond.
That was Bill Flynn on cross-examination, talking about how they were getting their stories straight. Okay. I'll try not to bore you with any more legalese, but it's important to note that another part of the petition for commutation states that Pamela Smart was also denied due process when the defense filed a motion to receive any exculpatory evidence from the prosecutor's office. But the prosecutor said they had no such information to provide. This was a lie. Cecilia Pierce testified during cross-examination that she was told by both prosecutors and police that she would not be arrested or charged. On paper, she had no deal. The defense made a really good argument that just an hour before her testimony, the prosecutors assured her she wouldn't be arrested or charged. Pete Randall said under cross-examination that he had been told that his own mother
would not be arrested on separate charges of concealing evidence if he took the plea deal. Randall would receive years instead of a mandatory life without the possibility of parole. In order to get that deal, he had to testify that Pam Smart planned the whole thing. The prosecution denied his claim, but Randall, he testified that it was true. Sisti pushed Pete during his cross.
The total plea agreement really isn't in this document, is it?
That is my plea agreement right there.
Well, isn't part of it that you were trying to take care of your mom, too?
No.
No, you didn't care?
I care for my mother. I was just told that she wouldn't be arrested. It wasn't part of my plea agreement.
And that was told to you by your attorney?
I believe it was my attorney that told me, correct.
And I assume that that was discussed with the prosecution?
I believe it was.
And it was only after you were assured that your mother wouldn't get in trouble that you gave him the specifics with regard to that bag, right?
No.
It was before that?
I believe it was.
You believe that or do you know?
I'm almost positive.
Did you call your mother?
Yes, I believe I did.
What did you tell her?
I told her that they'd be coming to look for the black bag.
To get it, that it's okay?
I told her that I had told them about the black bag.
All right. And that she could get it?
No, I had asked her what she had done with it.
Did you tell her it was all right to hand over?
No, I just told her they'd come looking for it. Right. I didn't tell her to get rid of it or anything. I just told her. I had told her once I knew they were going to look for it. I asked her, what did she do with it? She told me what she did with it.
And that she wouldn't get arrested?
No, I told her that they'd be coming to get it.
Did you tell her she was in trouble?
I didn't tell her she was in trouble, no.
I wanted to include this clip because there's something that the press does not talk about with this case, and that is that Pete Randall's mom and Bill Flynn's mom both destroyed and or hid evidence, yet they were never charged. And the lack of charges were never included in Pete and Bill's plea deals. But I would argue it was insinuated. If you want to take a deep dive on the nearly 700-page petition from 2018, I've posted it on the website, inbetweenpod.com. Have at it. There's a lot there. I'm also going to release reenactments of witness letters Pamela's mother, Linda Wojcicki, received over the years detailing experiences and interactions with Flynn and crew while they served time before, during, and after the trial. You can find that audio on the Grab Bag Collab main Patreon feed. Pete Randall and Bill Flynn were both paroled in 2015 after serving 25 years each for the murder of Greg Smart. J.R. Latamy served 15 years of an 18-year-to-life sentence, getting a 3-year sentence reduction in 2005. Raymond Fowler had pled guilty to murder conspiracy and attempted burglary in the Smart case and was sentenced to 15 to 30 years in prison. He was in prison from 1992 to 2003 when he was paroled. But in 2004, Fowler violated his parole when he visited his ex-girlfriend in Massachusetts in the middle of the night. Fowler said he went to talk to her because he'd heard she was doing drugs while pregnant with his child. Fowler was sentenced to 1 to 3 years on a witness tampering charge. He served the minimum term and is out of prison. Cecilia Pierce was never charged with accomplice to first or second degree murder and has never spent a day in prison for her role in Greg Smart's death. Pete and Bill's moms were also never charged for destroying and or hiding evidence. Pamela Smart remains in prison, serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole as of this recording. Now, there's only one other person that I briefly touched on in this episode who deserves an entire episode of her own, Cecilia Pierce, the 15-year-old intern of Pamela Smart, who helped plan the murder but received no sentence because she agreed to tape her conversations with Smart. But there are more than a few questions about Cecilia Pierce's role in the murder and the trial, including alleged forensic evidence that puts her at the scene of the crime, which, if true, would mean she perjured herself on the stand. Could Cecilia Pierce have the most to lose if Pamela Smart is released from prison? That's next on The In-Between.
The one thing that bothers me about this trial is that Cecilia Pierce got nothing.
Yeah, that's a big one for a lot of people.
Because she knew about it. That she was in all the planning. She knew what was going on. She knew she was sleeping with him. She knew that they were, you know, looking for a gun. She knew that they killed him, and she kept her mouth shut.
The only evidence that the state of New Hampshire had against Pamela Smart were 3 badly recorded wiretaps.
I'm not going to sit back here and say that it was overwhelming evidence, but it was certainly sufficient evidence to sustain the conviction.
Do you think there was anyone else at the restaurant with you that may have been underage? Supposedly my fingerprints were found on the thing and crap like that, end quote. The thing Cecilia Pierce is talking about, I don't know.
The shit he's saying, he's got to have something to back it up if he wants people to believe him, because it is pretty explosive shit.
He said that if they found out that I was lying to them, he'd go next door and indict me on charges of hindering evidence.
How did that make you feel?
Scared.
The In-Between is written, edited, and hosted by me, Mel Barrett. I also do some of the audio editing, but I couldn't content edit this sucker without the amazing Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Amber Hunt, my editor. Amber keeps me on track and helps cut the bullshit. Thanks, Amber. Thanks as well to my research partner and cousin-in-law, Lacey Umble. I also couldn't get this done without the kick-ass team at Grabbag Collab, Amber Hunt, Amanda Rossman, and Daisy Egan. The In-Between wouldn't exist without the encouragement and support of my dear friend, fellow podcaster, and all-around rock star, Yellen Marie Marsh. I love you, Ellen. Thanks for all you do. And I want to send another shout-out to Rebecca Lavoie over at Crime Writers On, who gave me my first feedback on the series and encouraged me to pitch it. Thanks, Rebecca. Finally, my love, my partner, Lindsay, your support and belief in me always keeps me moving forward, even when the way ahead is very dark. Thanks for doing this with me. Also, your reenactments are my favorite. If you want to dive deeper into the cases I cover, visit inbetweenpod.com for source material and updates. You can find all the episodes and bonus content of The In-Between on the Grabbag Collab main Patreon feed. Until the next time, be good people and don't do murder.